When journalist Richard Louv coined the term nature deficit disorder, he wasn't making a genuine medical diagnosis, but instead creating a metaphor for what many of us are missing, time spent in the natural world of sky, earth, plants, and animals. Louv argues there's a restorative benefit to being out in the natural world, away from cities, the indoors, and mass media, that doing so is good for our mental and physical health. Richard Louv has made his arguments in two books, and this Thursday he'll speak on the topic at the University of Illinois as part of Take a Child Outside Week. I'm Jim Meadows. Richard Louv talks about the new nature movement on Focus. Our program begins after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Richard Louv made a splash back in 2005 with his book Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. He followed that up a couple of years ago with The Nature Principle, Reconnecting with Life in a Virtual Age. Louv went on to help found the Children and Nature Network, which you can find online at childrenandnature.org. And that group is one of the players in what's called the New Nature Movement. Richard Louv is speaking at the University of Illinois this Thursday. It's part of local activities in the Champaign-Urbana for Take a Child Outside Week. There's a fee for attending a 7 p.m. talk at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center, but there's no cost for listening to him now on Focus and phoning or emailing your comments and questions. Richard Louv, welcome to Focus.
Thank you, Jim.
And I'm wondering, what we're talking about here is the importance of having the natural environment as part of our lives. Was there any specific thing, any aha moment that got you thinking along these lines?
Well, I was actually a kid once and spent a lot of time in the woods. I grew up outside of Kansas City at the suburban edge of Kansas City. And even then I had this real intense sense that this was more than it appeared, that there was something there that was nurturing me and other people. And I don't mean that in a religious sense, but I also always associated health with my family being outdoors. My father had a mental illness, and as he got worse, he spent less and less time outside. Now, whether or not that was the cause, you know, that aggravated his illness or not, or was the result of it, I don't know. But for some reason, you know, I associated that with being healthy. My family time when I was a kid was best when I was outside and healthiest. So it really goes back to that. But in terms of the, you know, as a journalist in the late 1980s, I was researching a book called Childhood's Future, and I interviewed about 3,000 parents and children, usually in groups and living rooms and classrooms all over the country. And I was looking for the repeating themes, kind of the kitchen table conversation rather than the conference table conversation. And I wanted to know what families thought was changing. And one of the themes that kept coming up again and again was this sense by parents that something was beginning to change, that some profound change in the relationship between children and nature, that they were having a harder and harder time getting their kids outdoors. So even then, it was beginning. But over the next 15 years, it intensified. And two bodies of research, one showing the extreme deficit, began to emerge. And then the other body, which I find more interesting, much of it, or at least some of it, was done in Illinois, the research showing the benefits, psychological benefits, learning benefits, health benefits in general, of being in nature, that there was something special about it.
And that's something in your book, Last Child in the Woods, you refer to something that you label the eighth intelligence. I suppose there's a hierarchy there, but the idea of certain things that your body and your nervous system and your senses are aware of in a natural environment that you lose when you don't have that sort of stimulus around you.
Yeah, and I expanded that idea in the Nature Principle. one of the problems with calling it the eighth intelligence is that it suggests to some people, in the way that's often presented, that that's a particular learning style that only some kids have. And it's not. I mean, it affects all of us. We're a species that needs nature. In the Nature Principle, in the first chapter, and the title of it is Singing for Bears, I'll tell you why in a minute, I talk about the fact that scientists who study the human senses no longer talk about just five senses. In fact, they talk conservatively about 10 senses, and many of them are studying as many as 30 senses. And all of these have names, and we're not aware of many of them, but we have, for instance, some of the ability of bats to use echolocation. People who have lost their sight, some of them are learning how to do this. Studies of military folks in Iraq and Afghanistan show, the military actually did studies, why do some soldiers know that there's something bad down that alley and others don't? And the people who grew up more in contact with nature or in a tough inner city neighborhood had a lot more awareness. They had some kind of, some would call it a sixth sense, but I think it's a cluster of these senses that are really developed by your environment outside your home.
You said nature or a tough inner city neighborhood, which
yeah.
sounds in some ways pretty unnatural, but there's something in common?
Well, I think if you're out, you know, other than the New York subway, when else do you use all of your senses at the same time as you do when you're outside in nature? The two are related in that you're very aware of what's going on around you, unless you have you know, your iPods stuck in your ears.
For kids, is this also part of an idea of what sort of play they're engaged in and what sort of structure, you know, how that play is structured?
It is, and this is some of the good news. I mean, we know from studies in Scandinavia, but also studies in the United States and Canada, that if you look at two types of play areas, for instance, on schoolyards, one type is the traditional flat, either turf or asphalt playground play area. The other kind is more natural. It's got curves and bushes and grass and trees and maybe a community garden, maybe a school garden. In those two types of play areas, there's a real difference. Kids in the flat area, the leaders who tend to emerge in the flat playground, typical playground, tend to be the physically strongest. Nothing wrong with being physically strong, but it does have something sometimes to do with bullying. The kids who emerge as leaders in the more natural play space tend to be the smartest. And that makes sense because they found that kids in a natural play space are far, far more likely to invent their own games than kids in a flat playground. And the kids who, when they play in a natural play space, are far more inclusive. Gender differences tend to disappear more. Ethnic differences tend to disappear. So there are a lot of advantages to playing in natural play spaces. In addition, schools that have truly greened themselves, and by that I mean become more natural in the environment, but also in the classroom, but also around the school, grades go up. I mean, there really is a significant connection between how natural a school setting is and how well kids do, even on standardized testing.
Well, we certainly welcome your input into the conversation. Is being out in nature an important part of childhood? Was it an important part of your childhood? Tell us about it at 1-800-222-9455. That's toll free, 1-800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. And I tell you, we've already gotten, Richard, advanced comments about this program, interesting questions coming in from a regular contributor here at WILL, and it's Rob Cantor from the University of Illinois. He does a regular feature for us called The Environmental Almanac, and he said he's not able to listen live, but he sent us some questions in. One thing Professor Cantor was wondering about is the nature of the nature of communities these days and the dominance of cars. He's wondering that it might really be harder now for kids to get around than get around like they used to years ago, because there are so many cars on the road, and pedestrians and cyclists are muscled out, so it just may be harder to access natural areas.
Well, he's right. I mean, there are, I categorize the barriers to nature in five categories. One of them is urbanization without nature, and traffic is a real fear, is a real concern of parents, and we've had really bad urban design in many areas for a long time, in which sometimes there's no place to walk, no sidewalks. In a rural area, that's fine, but in a dense urban area, people have to be separated from cars. But also just the increasing traffic, the increasing width of roads. I mean, you know, parents get preached at a lot about get your kids outdoors and, you know, have them walk to school, et cetera, and that is a good thing. But in some neighborhoods, and I'm not only talking about, you know, inner-city neighborhoods, but it's even suburban neighborhoods, just try to walk a few blocks. First, where are you going to walk to? You know, there may be, if you're lucky, a Starbucks within walking distance, but in many of these suburban neighborhoods, there's really no place to walk to. And then you have to cross freeways, let alone the street in front of you that might be too crowded. So traffic is definitely one of the barriers.
You've made it pretty clear in your books, you use a scientific-sounding phrase, nature deficit disorder, but it's not meant to be a scientific diagnosis. It's more of a metaphor. But have you found scientific support for the ideas that you're arguing?
There's an increasing number of studies, some of them done at the University of Illinois at Urbana, by Andrea Faber Taylor and Ming Kuo, are two of the most important researchers in this. This body of evidence is correlative, most of it. That means you don't have these long-term, 30-year longitudinal studies. That's because nobody thought to ask the question 30 years ago. But increasingly, this research does correlate better grades, better mental health, better physical health, and as I mentioned, the more ability to learn to our role in nature, to being outside in nature, not only for kids but for adults as well. Just one recent study was done at the University of Kansas, and they took some young people backpacking, and they really did a good study of the impact of this on their cognitive abilities, their ability to learn, and also on their creativity. And they found significant increases just after 3 days out in the woods backpacking in cognitive abilities, ability to learn, but a 50% increase in creativity when they got back over when they'd left.
Well, what's going on out there in the woods when you send kids out there that improves their mental faculties like that?
You know, this is one of the most understudied and I think most important areas of our lives. Only recently have people like Ming Kuo and others really begun to look into this. So we really don't know the answer to that. We have some theories. My theory has to do with the full use of the senses. I mean, most of the day, I don't know if you're like me, but much of the day I work and look at a computer. Kids spend hours and hours, most of their life, either in a closed classroom or looking at computers, looking at screens, 54 hours a week, plugged into some kind of electronic medium. Kids are now, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. When you're doing that, when we are doing that, we are spending a lot of energy blocking out our senses, except for the senses we need to go allegedly anywhere in the world through the Internet. One of the reasons I called that that chapter I mentioned, the Singing for Bears, is because the story I tell there is going up a stream in Kodiak, Alaska, and being taught by an outdoors guy how to smell for bears. a very useful thing to know how to do. You don't want to surprise Alaskan brown bears, and you want to know if they're there or have been there recently, and there's a particular smell, odor that goes with that. So that's a good talent to have. When I came back from that trip, by the way, my younger son was with me. He says, this sure beats high school. So when we got back, there was a study that actually of college students that found that human beings, we have some bloodhound in us. We can actually track through the woods with our nose, with our eyes blindfolded, our ears plugged. And we can, one of the fascinating things of this study is they found that the college students, of course, college students as guinea pigs, the college students who did this intuitively began to do what other animals that do this for a living do. They zigzagged. Now, they were blind. They had blindfolds on, ears plugged, and yet when they were following that trail, they zigzagged to find it and to follow it. So we spend most of our time, our kids spend most of our time blocking out as many as 30 senses. That, to me, is the definition of being less alive. Now, nothing wrong with computers. I use them all the time. Nothing wrong with technology, except for the fact that it's gotten out of balance for many of us. And so, you know, what parent wants their kid to be less alive? What adult really, truly wants to be less alive? Some people do. But I think that fundamentally that's what this comes down to is, are we fully alive? And I think when we cut out nature from our lives, we are less alive.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking about the role nature plays or should play in the lives of children, in the lives of all of us, actually, with Richard Louv, author of A Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle. He'll be talking at the U of I this Thursday. Contact the Urbana Park District for more information about his talk. There is a registration fee. Call us with your comments at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. You can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And I was wondering, in the case of the singing for bears incidents, when you were out in the woods being really aware of your surroundings, was there a lingering effect once you got back home, once you got back into the non-natural environment? Was there something that lingered as far as how aware you were through your senses and just essentially how you were using your nervous system?
I think that's a great question. The studies have shown that there is a residual effect. It does wear off. You have to renew it. And by the way, the reason I called it, just so people aren't confused, the reason I called that chapter Singing for Bears is when you're in that environment on Kodiak Island and elsewhere in Alaska, you make a lot of noise. You talk, you sing, you make a lot of noise to let the bears know you're coming.
So the bears won't be startled and they can make their
decisions.
That's
right. You don't want to scare a 2,000-pound Alaskan brown bear. So there is a residual effect, but it does have to be renewed.
Okay. You talk, you write a lot about the quality of play that should exist. Is there a difference between different types of play that children involved in, whether or not it has to do with what sort of environment they're in?
Well, I certainly think it does. We have to really look at the nature of that environment, though. And, you know, in cities we see the loss of urban parkland and the destruction of nearby neighbors and nearby nature within neighborhoods. We've had this false dichotomy of urban and nature. We're really seeing that for the first time in human history, as of 2008, more people now live in cities than in the countryside. First time in human history. Huge moment in human history. Now, the barrier there is not the city, but the absence of nature in the city. What this means, this huge change in the whole world, is that either people in the future will continue to lose their connection with nature and all the good that that brings to them, or it means the beginning of a new kind of city. And that's one of the things I'm most interested in, is how do we change our homes, our yards, our neighborhoods, our cities, to create more nature. I actually think that cities can become engines of biodiversity, that we can all be healthier and happier and maybe even smarter if we bring more nature into our cities. And some cities are doing a great job. Now, I don't know about Urbana-Champaign, but I do know about Chicago. Chicago's been doing a great job of increasing the amount of nearby nature, and they've been doing this for years.
That's a question I had, is what for in the terms of the positive contributions to quality of life, what constitutes a natural area? If there are things short of actually traveling many miles to get out in the wilderness away from cities, what sort of things can be done within a city?
I think that there are jobs that can be created to accomplish this. I think we can, you can incubate future entrepreneurs through the nurture of nature in cities. There are lots of ways, people who are emerging who, for instance, we had our backyard redone by a young woman in her 20s who makes a living changing yards into native species. And believe me, it is a great yard. I'm looking at it right now. It is so beautiful. And it's made up of native species. There are plants that bloom at different times throughout the year. It's attracting all kinds of insects and life that we've never seen before that are native to this region of California in which I live. That's a kind of job that didn't exist a few years ago. And now there are more and more young people doing that. So this actually is a creator of jobs. And I think we should widen the definition of green jobs to include that kind of thing. Or biophilic architects who are building whole buildings now that are have nature woven into them, and they're finding that the people in those buildings are more productive, sick time goes down, turnover gets better. So I think there's an emerging kind of a new kind of city coming and new kinds of jobs that can be created.
You know, just talking about what you did in your own yard is making me think of elements of childhood play that I don't think I've thought about in years. And that's just, as a little kid, how much time I spent exploring and thinking about just anything like the weeds in the lawn and what were they and what little bugs were crawling around. And that may have been a lot of the wildlife that I saw that I could get close to, but it was something that I really thought about a fair amount, and I think a lot of other kids did too.
It did, and that has a profound effect on kids. I think it has also a profound effect on psychological health. And well, we know that already, but in terms of your view of the future, for example, I think. And I'm not alone in this. People like David Sobel at Antioch and others have warned us about what David calls ecophobia, which is when we take kids out of the backyard, when we take them out of nature, and then we tell them stories about the end of the world again and again and again, the environmental end of the world, and we're doing that, we're setting those kids up to associate nature for the rest of their lives with disaster, with apocalypse. And that plays right into one of the biggest barriers to kids getting outdoors, which is the fear of strangers. And there's a whole thing we could talk about with that. But we're really setting those kids up in a way that we shouldn't be. And there's plenty of time to talk to them about environmental destruction, et cetera, the real problems we do face. But early on, what you just described in your yard, when you were just rooting around and looking at bugs and learning on your own, that is profoundly important in connecting you to the rest of the world, the whole world, all of the world, just that little, activity that you were doing. Part of that is just independent play. And there's kind of two tracks here. One is the disappearance of nature in kids' lives and adult lives. But the other one is also the disappearance of independent play in kids' lives and adults' lives. And one of the things that is known about that independent make-believe play, when you're just out there building a little fort in the weeds, et cetera, that is the foundation of what's called executive function. It's a term about psychological development for of kids, That's the executive development is that part of your brain that controls yourself, that is your own executive, your own boss. That's developed early in life through independent make-believe play. Increasingly, we're seeing the disappearance of that kind of play. There was a study that was done a few years ago that repeated a study that was done in the 1940s, and they found that kids today, a seven-year-old today, has the executive function of a five-year-old in the 1940s. In other words, we've sliced away 2 years of child development for kids in terms of their ability to control themselves, be their own boss, become an entrepreneur when they grow up.
That's something I want to get back to in a moment, but right now I want to take a call on line four, Ray from Effingham, who I understand, Ray, you're on the air, that you spent a lot of time outdoors when you were a kid.
I did, and my father, he hunted, but it was strictly for food. You know, it wasn't for the thrill of kill, but he taught me to respect nature and that everything has a purpose. And, you know, when I went out in the woods, if I got stung, you didn't kill the animal. You learned that, okay, they have their purpose, and you respect them, and you just learn how to maneuver around those things. And, I mean, today I see so many people, you know, they have no problem running over animals in the road. Sometimes you can't avoid it, but when a turtle's crossing a road, if it's safe to pull over and get it off the road, because everything has a purpose. So I think because of my father being outdoors a lot, it's something kids today, I hope they learn that all these creatures are not really disposable. We need them, so... and I think that's kind of what you were talking about a minute ago. That was my comment.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the call, Ray. And I'm wondering, Richard, if that's the sort of if that's the sort of experience that you think kids need to have more of.
I do. One of the interesting things about really there's a movement that has emerged in the last few years to connect kids and now to connect adults to the natural world. And it's happening in Illinois. There are great grassroots campaigns that have emerged there. Chicago Wilderness has the No Child Left Inside campaign. There's a lot going on in your state in terms of that. And that one of the aspects of that movement that I find most interesting is that it brings people together who don't usually want to be in the same room. You'll have conservationists, environmentalists in the same room with hunters, and you'll have conservatives and liberals together in the same room, people who have come to nature from different directions and ended up at the same place. Nobody wants to be in the last generation where it's considered normal and expected for kids to go outside and just, you know, be a kid and play in nature and build that little fort in the woods. Nobody wants to be in that last generation.
Okay, let's take a call from line one. Eileen from Urbana, good morning. You're on Focus.
Thank you. And the last caller has in mind my same theme. I'd like Mr. Lou to know that when he gets here, he's going to come to Tree City, Illinois, or Tree City, USA, and you will be delighted when you see how many restored prairies that we have and that children go to. Also, we have another unique feature called a pollinatarium. All second graders in the Champaign School District have a trip to the pollinatarium, so they learn about pollinators, but they also learn that there are no bears there and that they're not going to get stung by bees. And I think that kind of education within the schools is going to carry forward for many of the children. And so we welcome you, and I know you're going to see our children's nature playscape on your visit, and so I think you'll be very pleased, and welcome to Champaign Urbana.
Oh, well, thanks. One of the things I'm going to do there is, in addition to the, you know, the speech at the Alice Campbell Center on Thursday night, is I'm going to help kick off this Take a Child Outside community forum at the University of Illinois is sponsoring, and they're really making a push to have more research done on the relationship between human beings and the natural world. And at that kickoff, there are going to be students and educators and practitioners who are going to present a lot of research papers and other material that focuses on issues of children and nature. It's very, very important that more people begin to look at this seriously, and Illinois is one of the places that's taking place.
Okay. Well, Eileen, thank you very much for the call. We're going to take a short break right now and then come back for more discussion with Richard Louv on the importance of natural spaces for children and adults. This is Focus on WILL. We're back on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. My guest today is Richard Louv, the man who coined the phrase nature deficit disorder. He's speaking Thursday evening at the University of Illinois Alice Campbell Alumni Center as part of local activities for Take a Child Outside Week. There's a registration fee. You should contact the Urbana Park District for more information. Do you have some examples of nature deficit disorder or perhaps the antidote? Call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. Phone number again is 1-800-222-WILL. And Richard, I was thinking of the idea of unsupervised play and remembering a book I had read years ago by Robert Paul Smith called Where Did You Go Out? What Did You Do? Nothing. And it was a nostalgic look looking back at the unsupervised play of Smith's childhood. Smith grew up in the 1920s. He was writing in the 1950s. And even then, he was complaining about children's playtime being overly supervised. The only structure, the Smith's childhood play, apparently, was the structure the children imposed on themselves. And I'm wondering, how is that important? And is that important in a way that is separate from the importance of natural spaces? Or how do they work together?
I think those two areas overlap. A few minutes ago you described, Jim, your experience as a kid just learning about the nature by poking around in your own yard when you were a kid and those hours you spent doing that. When kids and the rest of us, in fact, are outdoors, our senses are more keyed up unless, again, we've got the iPod stuck in our ears. So our senses are more alive out there. And so the independent play that we do out there, whether we're kids or adults, is intensified by that experience. So I think those two things are related in two ways. One is both are beginning to disappear or have been disappearing for some time as we go indoors, as we go into our electronics. And the second way that those are related is that they overlap. They tend to intensify the experience if you do both at the same time.
Rob Cantor, the environmental science professor that I mentioned earlier, among the questions he sent in, he was wondering how social structures affect this sort of play. He writes, "It seems to me there are a few neighborhoods with the kid density needed to support the roving bands that were typical when I grew up in the 60s and 70s. I think the dearth of potential pals to hang out with drives kids towards organized activities led by adults." And I guess what he's getting at is there's something missing in those organized activities that kids don't get when they're organizing things on their own.
Yeah, I have nothing against soccer. Soccer is good. Organized sports for children are fine. I mean, they do help with childhood obesity and other health issues that kids face. But you have to remember that the greatest increase in child obesity in our history occurred during the same two decades as the greatest increase in organized sports for children in our history. That doesn't mean one causes the other. That means something was taken away from kids' lives and replaced by organized sports or replaced by kind of constant supervision and surveillance, and a lot of it was indoors. There are lots of neighborhoods where there are still lots of kids in those neighborhoods. He's right in terms of the demographics, the shrinking family, et cetera, that has affected it. Other social changes have affected it. But the truth is that there are many neighborhoods where there are lots of kids, and you won't see them on the street. Every now and then you'll see them. And there are neighborhoods where this still happens. I want to make that clear. But many neighborhoods, for instance, in San Diego where I live, you'll drive through them, and there are they're filled with families, but no bodies on the street. Not only that, but the way that many of these new neighborhoods are structured are anti-nature, even if there's lots of green around, even if nature is part of the theme of the planned community. Just try to step on the grass, see what happens. Just try to, put up a basketball hoop, let alone build a treehouse or a fort, have your kids do that independently. It's not going to happen, and maybe the community association will come around and tear down that fort or treehouse if it does occur. And this is because almost all of the communities, all the neighborhoods built in the last 30 to 40 years are governed by CC&Rs. Many of them have community associations that do good things, but are also often draconian in their crushing of any kind of independent play. All houses must be beige in perpetuity. That's another big change that's happened in our country. And that can't be underestimated. Oftentimes people say, well, the kids in inner cities have it the toughest. In many ways they do, really, related to going outside in nature, because there's not much nature around. However, kids in the suburbs have different barriers, and I've just named a few.
Let me take another call. Scott from Homer. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I had a couple comments, actually. At least the newspaper advertisements for this visit have been funneling people through the Champaign County Forest Preserve District. And so if you go to ccfpp.org, there's a lot about this visit. And I mean, I do a lot of work with Urbana Park District and love those folks, but that's what the printed media has said, and I've visited that website. And certainly I wanted to just kind of mention, throw out an idea of sort of like a micro green environment. You know, at some point in time, I thought I almost heard the host say, not quite how big does a natural area have to be? And although we've got wonderful preserves, and I certainly second what the past caller said about the restored prairies that we have in town, I mean, I think really you can start this concept on a tabletop in a house in terms of, planting seeds or house plants or sort of get kids' hands dirty in that way. And so I don't think we want to leave the impression that it takes a formalized park district or a large set aside in order to at least get kids started on this whole reality of getting in touch with growing living things and, kind of getting external to the media processes that are in their reality and stuff. So great show, and I will ring off.
Thank you very much for the call. And Richard, what you were mentioning, he was talking about you don't need much to start with.
He's right. I think wilderness is extraordinarily important. I mean, we have to have wilderness as a species. We have to have wilderness, even though there's some question as to whether there really is any pure wilderness. Indigenous tribes in the United States, for instance, or what before it was the United States, burned off the prairie to create more forage area for bison. So they, in a sense, were ranching. So that's a tangent, but there's a whole discussion about what wilderness is. I'm even more interested in nearby nature, and not only the parks, but also our yards, our neighborhoods, even down the alley in an inner-city neighborhood. And I'm promoting this idea that I'd love your listeners to think about. It's not my idea. A fellow in Delaware, a professor, a botanist and entomologist, who has this idea for homegrown national park. And what that would mean would be that I would change my yard into native species, and maybe the next door neighbor, and maybe three houses over, they'd do it. And pretty soon, if enough people do this, you've got wildlife corridors on private land going throughout cities, and maybe to the next city and the next city. And what if we made that a national or international campaign to have a huge homegrown national park that you don't have to wait for Congress to pass a bill? You can start it and you can do it yourselves. I mean, what if natural history museums started handing out native plants and seedlings and seeds. And the same for libraries. Libraries could distribute this information as well as the plants themselves. Think of the power that kids would have if they were part of something that large that could actually bring back native butterfly migration routes, that could bring back bird migration routes, and they can do this. You know, Doug Ptolemy, the professor I'm describing, he's run the numbers, and he says that if we really want to deal with the biodiversity crash in our world, in the United States in particular, we'll probably spend less money in Brazil because you don't know where it's going, and start changing our yards. And if we change 40% of our yards in the United States, we'll have an immense impact on the biodiversity of our nation.
Well, that's an interesting concept, to actually grow the natural area right around you.
Right, and it improves your life. I mean, it not only in the act of doing it, but also the impact of it later. It really does stimulate the senses. It really does do great things for our mental health, our physical health, and I think our spiritual health, too.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for questions for Richard Louvre about nature deficit disorder and resolving it. Call 1-800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, toll free, 1-800-222-WILL. Let me go to line two. Dan, good morning. You're on
good
Focus.
Morning. Yes, good morning. I had my initial comment I called for actually was being talked about. Another impact of replacing, say, your lawn with the native species, different plants, is also you're not out there mowing your lawn. You're saving the gasoline and not putting exhaust out in the environment and such. But my initial reason for calling was one impact that I've seen observed about the younger generations not getting outside as much. When I was active duty Army, of course, in the Army, you interact with the outdoors considerably, the different climate conditions and the plants and the animals and the insects and so forth. And not playing outside, kids are even weaker, but I notice that kids struggle because they're not used to being in the outdoors, in the trees, in the prairie environments and so forth, and they don't know how to dress for the different temperatures and that. And it really gives them a difficult time, say, through basic training and advanced training and such in the Army, and it's really a big impact on the readiness of our military. And that's just another aspect of this nature deficit that I just thought I'd mention, just more food for thought. So I thank you. That's really all I had. I thought I'd just hang up and listen if you had any comment on that. So. Thank you again, but the Army does do a good job of getting everybody trained, but it's a little more difficult when kids haven't had a chance to play outside when they're younger. So, thank you, and I'll listen to the rest of the show.
Thank you very much, Dan. Now, Army duty is definitely structured activity, but it sounds like there's just some common sense sort of familiarity that you get from being outdoors, and if you don't get outdoors, you're not going to learn that stuff.
Yeah, I should make clear I'm not against structured experience in nature. I mean, what I think kids miss most is unstructured free play, particularly in a natural environment. However, parents are so scared. This is a fear that I felt as a parent, even though I knew better. I knew about the numbers. I knew that violent crime against kids has actually been going down for at least 30 years. Stranger abductions are not nearly the number that we think they are, and that's because of my profession in part, journalism and media, entertainment media really makes us very afraid. Given the fact of that fear, which is one of the big barriers, in order to give kids some semblance of unstructured activity, we're probably going to have to structure a lot of it, and that's an irony that we're just going to have to deal with a sense of humor. And there are nature centers and other institutions and organizations that are figuring out how to do this in a way that still gives kids some kind of independent play experience. Something I should also mention, the caller brought up a great point. At the other end of that experience, though, what we're seeing is the emergence of quite a few therapy programs that are working with returning veterans and their families and getting them outside, into nature as a way to deal with some of the problems that come with having been at war. And again, both for the soldier, but also for the soldier's family.
I want to take another call. This is line three. Dave in Champaign, good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes, you've dealt with this a little bit, but we're mowing the world to death. And Illinois is especially fond of mowing roads. They mow not just one bush hog 15 feet, they mow 30 feet. That takes out the pollinators and takes out the ambiance that you see from a car, let alone anything else. And it's always done at the wrong time of the year, just as the prairie plants are starting to bloom, so goes the mower and the pollinators. And it's a huge, huge expense. And DOT has been trying to do something about it, but it needs a lot of encouragement from the world at large.
Okay, Dave. Well, thank you very much. Richard, I was wondering, that sounds like a little thing, just how much mowing gets done along the roadways, and whether it's in urban or rural areas. Do you think that makes a difference as far as what kids and adults are able to interact with as far as their own natural environment?
I think it does, and I think it's one example of the fact that nearby nature could be everywhere. I mean, we could be seeing it in very unexpected places, and there are some cities that are beginning to realize that. One of the things I'm going to talk about at the university on Thursday night is how we think about the future. I'd like, people have these great examples, but I'd like to put those examples inside a larger container. By that I mean, one of the things I'm most concerned about is how we talk to young people, to children and ourselves, about what the future looks like. I was sitting with some students at DePaul University a few months ago, and these were environmental studies students, and yet they were very depressed. They were depressed about the future. They didn't feel that they had any relationship with the big environmental organizations, which, by the way, are aging quickly. One of the biggest national environmental organizations, the average membership age is 78. The average new member is 74, believe it or not. So they're beginning to age out, and they realize that, so they're doing a big effort. But these students I was sitting with didn't seem to feel welcomed by the environmental movement, at least the big organizations. The other thing was one young woman, 20 years old, she says, I'm 20 years old, and all my life I've been told it's too late. And I was stunned. I mean, think about that for a second. She's right.
Well, too late for what?
Too late to save the earth, too late for nature, too late for a good future.
Really?
That's the message she gets from media. And when you think about it, when you start looking around, yes, there's good news out there. Yes, people think about different good things we could do in the future. But I'm convinced that most Americans, when they think about the far future, the images that first come into their mind are ones that look a lot like Blade Runner and Mad Max and The Hunger Games. At least in The Hunger Games, you got some nature. But for most of these, nature has been stripped from humanity along with our humanity. And I think those are the dominant images that our culture carries around about the future. But what if we change that? What if right now we don't have a good set of images to replace that, other than maybe sustainability, which is mainly about getting by and surviving. It's not enough. Martin Luther King said and demonstrated in many ways that any movement, any culture will fail if it cannot paint a picture of a world that people will want to go to. What if we began to paint a picture not only of a world that's sustainable, energy efficient, and all of that, got to do that, but what if we began to paint a picture of a world that is nature-rich homes, nature-rich yards, nature-rich cities, neighborhoods, workplaces, schools that are filled with nature, in which, again, cities become engines of biodiversity, in which we are no longer seeing ourselves as alone on the earth, as one species.
So you're talking about not just changing, not just preserving, like, say, hundreds of thousands of acres of untouched wilderness, which can be a good thing to do, but also preserving the nature and maybe upping the nature quotient right where we live.
That's right. One of the basic precepts of the nature principle, the second of the two books, is that conservation is no longer enough. Now we need to create nature. As strange as that sounds, if we begin to transform our cities and workplaces, schools, we're in essence creating more natural habitat. We have to conserve what we have, but conservation alone isn't enough. One of the problems that conservationists face right now, and wildlife biologists, many of them feel overwhelmed by the problems that are out there. I'm not diminishing that at all in terms of climate change, et cetera. But they feel so discouraged. And I've met many conservationists, environmentalists, wildlife biologists who have begun to change that depression that they feel by connecting kids to nature, by getting involved in programs that create more nature in cities. I think that we're not only talking about the conservation of land and water, we're talking about that we need to conserve conservation, the conservation of conservationists. And to do that, we have to turn this corner and begin to not only think about sustainability, not only begin to talk only about holding on to what we have, but of creating more of it, a different kind of city and a different kind of future.
Richard Loeb, I'm afraid that's all the time we have, but you can see Richard Loeb speaking Thursday night on the U of I campus at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center, called the Urbana Park District or the Champaign County Forest Preserve District, for more information. Richard, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Today's show produced by Lindsay Moon, Jason Croft, our technical director, and handles your calls. Sari Lesk is our invaluable intern. This is Focus on WILL.